I'm here with Zach Kildish, the director of 1922, based on a Stephen King story, and we're going to discuss with him how he got it made.
Yeah, well, it was a very, it was kind of a quick, crazy journey in many ways, but it all goes back to me stumbling across the story. Like, I was always a Stephen King fan. I hadn't read everything he's ever written, but I was a, you know, I was obsessed with It as a kid. So very fortuitous that it's coming out, you know, same year as my movie. I was trying to get financing for my last film, These Final Hours. And I remember while me and the producer were just waiting on, you know, people's decisions, as a way of escape, I sort of stumbled across this Stephen King book that had just come out called Full Dark, No Stars. And I read a review of it, and I was like, oh, wow, this sounds pretty cool for four novellas in the one book. So I picked it up and read the first story, 1922, and it just completely blew me away. Like, and it just took my mind off trying to get this film funded. And then when I put it down, I just thought, wow, like, I wonder who's going to end up making this film, because it was just so cinematic, and it just reeked of like a Frank Darabont film. And so I put it away and just didn't think too much about it. Anyway, we ended up getting our funding for These Final Hours. We made that film, and that did okay for itself to open up some doors to the States for me. So then when I was over there, like playing the game over there, trying to get the next thing up, my mind just kept coming back to 1922. And I just sort of asked, like, has anyone got the rights to it? Has anyone ever reached out about it? And no one even knew what 1922 was.
Oh, really?
So that was kind of good for me. So I wrote King a letter expressing my love for him and 1922, and I was then allowed to proceed with an adaptation. I'd never adapted anything before in my life either, so this was like a baptism of fire. But talk about a great cheat sheet to do your first adaptation with. Like, he wrote the thing as like a piece of cinema to me. Like, it was just so visual and so compelling, and all from one character's point of view, which is the kind of movies that I really love. And he gave my adaptation his blessing, and then the real fun started. We're trying to get the thing financed over there in the States, which was not easy, and a lot of people said no. But I then teamed up with this producer called Ross Dinnerstein, and we had had a few meetings over the last few years. We were always sort of looking for the right project to work together on, and when the adaptation landed on his lap, he loved it, and he said, I've got a golden run with Netflix right now. Like, I want to do this at Netflix. I love the script, let's go. And I was like, are you kidding? Sure. Where do I sign up? So it was really those planets aligning, the script getting to Ross falling in love with it, and then we took it to Netflix, and yeah, they said yes, and off we went.
So when you knew that this was going to be a Netflix project, did that, was it just the same as if you had been doing it as a cinema release movie?
Oh, absolutely. Like Beast of No Nation, like, that was such a cinematic movie. Yeah. And having just seen that, and that being a Netflix original, I was like, well, yeah, we're just making a piece of cinema. Like, I never even thought about this being seen on a small screen, because for one, everyone's TVs are so big these days anyway. You're already sort of getting that cinematic experience. So it never really crossed my mind too much that we weren't just making a traditional piece of cinema.
That does it make a difference to you knowing that millions upon millions of people actually have access to this in a way that they don't if it had been a traditional piece of cinema?
Yeah, well, you know, there's just so much content out there these days that giving the film a fighting shot, given that it's a King property as well, that definitely helps. But just the fact that it will be on Netflix forever as a Netflix original, like the amount of eyes that will hopefully get to see this thing, more so than if it was, you know, released traditionally with a small theatrical. I mean, this isn't a big blockbuster either. This is a tiny film in many ways, that just so happens to be a Stephen King property. I think this is just exactly the right kind of way to release this kind of film as well, which isn't necessarily, the film is many things. It's not a straight horror. It's not a straight drama. It's not a straight thriller. Like it's a mixture of genres. And to me, the thing that really appealed to me was that it was like a Stephen King all-star game of a story. You know, everything we associate King with, you know, cornfields, rats, ghosts, murder, mayhem, revenge, just all of these ideas are all in this one amazing novella.
All right, so let's get into a little bit of those King elements, like the cornfields and the rats. It's not giving too much away to say that if you find rats spooky in any way, then this is the very film for you. Because you worked with, well, let's find out. Apparently, you worked with a ton of rats.
We did. We worked with a shit ton of rats. And God bless the animal wranglers in Vancouver where we shot the film. They worked miracles. And I'd never been around, like, more than one rat in my life. So then to all of a sudden, you're around 200 rats at the same time and you're rolling. It's like, okay, I'll be all right, I think.
So are they sort of beautifully clean lab rats, or what's the deal?
These were kind of beautiful rats in many ways. We had every color under the rainbow, but the more time you spend around them, the more cute they seem, which was kind of a problem. We needed to do everything we could to make them creepy. It's the tails mostly that get people.
Okay.
The tails and their tiny little hands, like those are the creepy elements.
And so when you working with, I'm just having a think about your actors, and I'm going to guess that at least one of your actors might have been a little rat phobic. How did they find working with 200 rats?
Yeah, well, Thomas, he didn't give two shits. He was just in the character so much. One rat or 50 rats, like it didn't bother him. He was amazing. He had many photos when we were rolling with them on his head, and you know, he was having a grand old time with the rats. Molly maybe didn't handle the rats as well, because again, like, hey, welcome to the set, and now we're gonna just have like 100 rats just hanging out around you and sort of like by your feet and all those sorts of things. But she was a trooper, and yeah, I mean, when you see the movie, you'll see the amount of rats that she had to kind of deal with.
I understand that, you know, we live in the world of digital effects, but, you know, how is it to direct rats? What do you do?
It's the rat wranglers. You've got to figure out exactly what angles and exactly what shot you're trying to get, and then it's all over to the wranglers. Okay. And if this was a family of rat wranglers, all right, it was a sight to behold. This tight unit who just have these 200 rats in tubs, and we explain the shot, we explain what needs to happen, and wow, like everything we thought was maybe impossible for a rat to do, they just were like, no. No, we can train that rat to do that. Wow. It'll be fine.
And how long for a particular thing might it take to train a rat?
You were just rolling and waiting on those situations. A lot of it's noise-based. So there was this clicker that they had, which is like trying to get them from go from A to B. They're also, you know, rewarded by food. But once that rat's eaten that food, it doesn't want to do the trick anymore. So that's why you have to have all these rats in reserve to then bring in the B unit, the C unit, the D unit, to keep getting your takes done. Yeah.
Wow, that sounds very...
Many tricks of the trade when it comes to rat wrangling.
Very precise. Now, obviously, 1922 is, as the title suggests, set in the 1920s. Obviously, you shot in Vancouver.
Yep.
And how much of what you did was pretty much authentic? Because looking at the film, it looks like you've got a great sort of 1920s set location. How much of that was actually there?
It was a challenge trying to do anything period 1920s Nebraska in modern day Vancouver, even rural Vancouver. Like basically, you know, a lot of this movie is set in a house, in and around a farmhouse, on a cornfield with a giant barn. Like, those were the three big things that we needed. And we found the perfect house from the
20s. Right.
This place called Bleeburger House, which is one of the most filmed in locations in Vancouver, and therefore I think the earth, because a lot of things are shot in Vancouver. And once you see this house, you'll start seeing it in other things.
Okay.
But it's a period house, and it's still intact, and it was perfect. So we decided to work backwards from there. It was like, that's the non-negotiable. Mm. There's no corn anywhere near this house. Vancouver has corn, but not near that perfect house. So, nor was there a big red barn. So we had to build the facade of a barn, and just figure out the corn from there. And figuring out the corn from there sounded easy at the time, but then let's just say in post production, there was a lot of work. We put our VFX teams through hell, Yeah, the end results are amazing. And we had an amazing production designer, Paige Buckner. He worked miracles, like every day, trying to create this look for us, as did our DOP, Ben Richardson, who's a crazy genius. And between the two of them, like, I knew I was in safe hands in trying to make this crazy idea of creating that world in Vancouver without the things that we needed. We just sort of tried to figure it out as we went.
So there's a real cornfield?
There are, in the movie, there are some real cornfields, yeah. There are then plates shot from, you know, from here in Australia, then you know, through the magic of VFX, putting them into the film, and there was a lot of blue and green screen action going on in some of those exteriors. It's just the only way we could do it, really. We just had to power through.
Now, I believe you actually have the right, you even have to have the right type of corn, because not all corn is the same.
That's right. We had to have maize corn, which is that classic Stephen King corn. There's many different types of corn, as I now know. We had to find the right corn. And luckily, when we shot, people were just finishing up their harvest, so we could do some scenes in real corn, and that was great. This is a mixture of plates, of real corn, of real fake corn, corn that we imported in from China. It was a mishmash of just trying to get as much corn on screen when we needed to.
So you're now the rat and corn guy.
That's right.
And you don't know about these.
I want to never work with the two again.
So talking about the King story, just taking you back to when you were discussing that you fell in love with the original story. Just let's talk a little about Stephen King for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about the story that you, that at that point when you didn't know you were going to adapt it or make it, let's just talk a little about what you liked about that story.
Well, I think that the thing that King does is he just puts you in the headspace of a character, whether or not it's an everyman who's your hero or it's a villain. Like, he puts you in the headspace. Mm. And Wilfred James, this creation of his, is a guy who just makes the worst possible decision when his livelihood is threatened by his wife. Everything he associates with being a man and his place in the world is a threat, and it's all because of his wife. And the way he deals with that, he makes a terrible decision, and then it's about dealing with the repercussions of that. And there was just something really tragic but really immersive about being in the headspace of a character like that, where you're constantly doing the, I hate this guy, I can kind of see where he's coming from. No, he shouldn't have done it. And constantly from page to page, you're just wrestling with this guy whose headspace you're locked into, because he's confessing the whole story to you through his point of view, writing it as a confession. So in terms of it being a very personal story for this character, like, it couldn't be more that. So therefore, by the end of it, you really feel like you've gotten to know this guy. He's just such a complicated, complicated figure who has so much empathy and so much sympathy, and he's a smart farmer, but he just acts out in this primal way, and then has to deal with what he did, and Yeah, it was just a really compelling story.
Well, Thomas Jane is your Wilfred, and he does a fantastic job in the role. What was that process of finding him?
Well, I was over in LA, and Thomas had read the script and wanted to meet and have lunch. And so we had lunch, and in that meeting, I walked away from it saying, we found out Wilfred James. Thomas had already done 2 Stephen King films by that point, so this is his third. And he had never played anything like this before, and he just got the material. And that's all you want out of your leading man, you know? You just want someone who connects with the material, who is going to do all the work, who just is going to put their own spin on it, but just loved the story like I did and wanted to just put this on the screen. And, I just was in that meeting looking at him going, wow, this guy, there's something about this guy, and he is Wilfred James. And there's not a lot of actors out there that I feel like could have gone there or just really lost themselves in this role.
Well, I think convincingly playing somebody of that era, because it's not simple just to sort of say, I don't think it's simple to just say guy from the 1920s, farmer, depression era sort of farm, and yet he seems to perfectly get it. So.
Yeah, it's like he went in a time machine when you watch the movie, and it's like, how is this what? Like, he is just living and breathing the 20s, and he just looks the part, and he just symbolizes what that was like for those men back then. These Dorothy Lange photos, you know, they were a big inspiration and reference for us when we were trying to figure his look out. There's just some photos in the archive there where it's like, yep, that's Wilfred James right there with his son out on the field.
Is it sort of Dust Bowl era type stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. And when how did you communicate with him, I guess, on set? Is he someone that liked to talk a lot or not so much?
He was just in the character, and because he's in every scene and it's his movie, you know, this is the Wilfred James show. It was just doing a lot of our work together, when we weren't on set, you know, we'd catch up, we'd talk about the weeks, the week ahead, and we'd have dinner and we'd just talk about all the things that we were going to be doing. And you know, we would just go through them and he'd ask questions and I'd ask questions. And so by the time we got to set, it was kind of like we'd done a lot of the homework, and it was now just playing with that. And he's just great, even just to block with, you know, you'll set the scene and then you bring the actors in and he'll just have an idea. And usually it was always the right instinct that he had, you know, I wouldn't be sitting, I'd be standing, and this is why. And you're like, absolutely. this is your house, you know. So going in with preconceived notions of exactly how things were going to go down, sometimes things were just exactly as I sort of thought they were going to be. And then Thomas would just bring such another level to it where, again, without an actor that committed to the piece and just really thinking things through, you know, and I think those results speak for themselves. When you see the film, he is just, the living embodiment of the 20s and that man.
Well, there are actually quite a few interiors, even though it is set on a farm. And so how much, doing a bit of on-the-fly mathematics, how much time did you spend shooting interiors?
Well, the whole shoot was a 5-week shoot. So we shot 25 days, 12-hour days, though, as opposed to a show which is 10. So I kind of got an extra 2 every day, which without those extra 2, I don't know how we would have made a movie. So that was the benefit of shooting over there. I'd say it almost feels like a 50-50 split of interiors and exteriors. We basically shot everything we needed to, and then we ended the shoot at the house, and the house was where the main crux of everything happens. So that was good, just being settled into that house, because everyone just sort of, you know, felt like they were living in that 1920s house for those last 3 weeks of the shoot. But we also were just at the cusp of like one of the worst storms, one of the worst megastorms that ever swept through Vancouver. So that last week we were starting to get rained out, and you know, we started with grassy knolls and plots of land like that near the house, and by the end of that last week, like, it was Woodstock. Like, you could hardly walk. It was just mud everywhere. Like, we destroyed that grass, which had to all be replanted because it's like a heritage home. But yeah, the gods were not kind in that last week, and that was a bit of a struggle. But thank God to our VFX team, whether we were on the porch or whatever. But yeah, we were kind of dictated to a lot by what we needed to cover just at the house. So we started running out of rain cover days for the stuff we could shoot as interiors and whatnot. But we managed to scrape through it and all.
Okay, let's just talk now about a little more about your other actors. It seems, by just thinking it through, it seems that obviously you did quite a bit with Molly Parker. So how was she to work with?
Oh, she was a dream. Like, just such a cool chick. Yeah, we just really hit it off. And she was my first choice. It was great to use a Canadian local. Like, she grew up in Langley, which is sort of the rural area of Vancouver where we shot. So it was kind of all meant to be. But her and Thomas together was just great. And there's not a lot of scenes that we got to do with them together, but when we did do those ones and with their son, Henry, those were sort of the favorite scenes of mine, doing the family dynamic stuff. But yeah, Molly was just great. Yeah.
Was she similar to Thomas in that she's someone who's knows what she's going to be doing, has thought it through, and just brings a lot to the part?
Yeah. Again, it's just asking lots of questions. We didn't get to spend a lot of time before she arrived on set, whereas me and Thomas had a bit more time. So by the time she arrived on set, we just had to figure a lot of things out as we were already shooting. But no, she was great. And again, I just love blocking in the actual space with the actors, like, and just figuring things out as we go, and letting them sort of, you know, lead the way. The two of them, it was just great watching them dance together and some of their great little one-on-one scenes. They were really fun to shoot.
Yeah, I remember in watching it, one of the things that occurred to me was I wonder how these two got together, which is a great thought to have, because the moment you're thinking that in the audience, you're completely buying the relationship.
Oh, good.
So it was that they generate an interesting sort of dynamic together, don't they?
Yeah, very yin and yang. And it's kind of, we meet these two at the death of their marriage, you know, like the marriage is already sort of not great, but but they're just so good together that you sort of think, okay, like, I wonder, yeah, how did they meet, and what brought them to this point? And you know, she's just done with this whole lifestyle, so it's a very very primal, very instantly relatable situation that she's in, which I think is great, because like, it just sort of sets everything up. Watching what happens next is then very, very, very hopefully not too predictable. But
Well, the thing is that because it is 1922, you and of the rural setting, you immediately get a feeling of, well, this isn't, whatever happens, it's not going to be easy. It's not like the modern world where, you know, you can sort of more easily divorce someone. So, yeah, you know, it's very obvious that whatever's coming is going to be difficult. So
yeah,
you definitely get that sense.
Yeah, and for her to have such a powerful card in that time, in that era, by inheriting her dead father's land, like, gives her this massive bargaining chip, and not a lot of women had those, and she tries to cash hers in, and I wouldn't say hilarity ensues, quite the opposite, but there's definitely consequences to what she tries to do for her family.
Well, you say that, but there's actually, and I found there was an interesting streak of black humor running through this.
Yeah, and that's King, like just that writing of his, like, you know, like, I feel like all of his stories have some level of really, really dark humor. And that's what just really, it definitely made adapting this, like, just really fun, because, like, all those little things I just had to keep, like, all those little weird elements and just those little idiosyncrasies, like I just tried to retain as many of them as I could. And, yeah, he just wrote some really great characters, in this story.
So when you found as an adapter, I guess you were given a lot of gifts. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And he left the story in such a cinematic shape that, like, yeah, all I did was just transplant what was already there, really. Yeah, so I'd say it's quite a faithful adaptation. Obviously, some things had to be changed whenever you're trying to visually create something, bring something to the screen. But yeah, like the story just reads so well that I saw the whole thing in my head, and just seeing the movie now, I'm just really proud that, like, that world I saw in my head is so close to, like, the finished product. So I feel like we've done the story a service.